And welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we have, well, I don't think you'll hear much from us. Well, not much from you anyway, because I did a lot of interviews. We had Winter Pride here in Ottawa, which was the first of its kind in the city, where Capital Pride has teamed up with Canadian Heritage to do a Winter Pride in a couple of days, or just last week we would have a march onto Parliament, going through Spark Street. Madove from Montreal was performing at a cabaret show. There was a gala with Trinity and Derek Barry from RuPaul's Drag Race.
And this is all during Winterlude, Ottawa's major winter festival?
Absolutely,
yeah. If ever you've seen a photo of Ottawa, chances are it's the canal in summer where everything is green and pretty, or the canal in winter where it's covered in people skating.
Yeah.
Basically, it's always pictures of the canal because it's one of the few parts of town that's really pretty. Super and photogenic. Pretty, yeah.
Well, we're going to jump into our first interview. I did this interview with Haran, who is the executive director of ASAP. And we'll be back just after that.
So I am here at the Fierté Canada Pride National Conference in Ottawa, at the Delta, that has some truly incredible folks coming together to kind of speak about the future of Pride. But I want to take a quick sidetrack from that conversation to talk about what has dominated the news and dominated the kind of conversation in at least southeastern southern Ontario, which is the Bruce MacArthur, which are now, I believe, they're calling a killing spree. The Crown attorneys are very hesitant towards using serial killer. But, I mean, there's a whole politic involved with that as well. I am here with Haran, who has been so key in talking in the community for the Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention, is the organization that you're the executive director of. What's been going on? Because I know your impact statement was read out today. For the folks out in, you know, Hunter's Bay or Muskoka, Ontario, what on earth is going on in Toronto?
Well, I think that's been a question since last year, or for several years now, even within the community in Toronto, in terms of what's going on. So, I mean, Bruce MacArthur, over the last year and a half, the homicide unit at TPS, with the direction of Detective Nzinga, and who's now Inspector Nzinga, had brought Bruce MacArthur to justice through their investigation, and we're grateful for that. And they were so meticulous that there was enough evidence to actually have him plead guilty, and I think that's sort of what the conversation was between the lawyers. And so now we've brought him to justice. Now all the questions are still there in terms of, you know, why did it take so long? Why eight men? And it's pretty clear why he targeted the men that he did target, because a lot, I mean, including Andrew, there was a class issue for sure. A lot of them were living at or below the poverty line. They were precariously housed. Some of them had substance issues. Some of them had mental health issues. So there was a group of individuals, and I also have to point out that many of them had contact with family, but it was a distant contact, it seemed, and with intermittent conversations, because either they lived away or whatever the situation was. And with Andrew, the family and the community came together because Andrew was so involved in the community.
He was the superintendent for the building, I believe.
He was a superintendent for the building, but he was also an outstanding community person. Like, he worked for the Toronto HIV Network, which didn't pay any money at all. He was a volunteer of the Toronto People with AIDS Foundation. So he was really tied to the community. And I talk about class and privilege, and sometimes when I speak about this, where race is an issue, where a white man had to go missing for all the other men of color, and a homeless man who wasn't reported missing, who also white, had to be connected and finally brought to justice. So I had to be mindful of that when I speak, because I know that racism may have played a role in terms of why the police did or did not investigate effectively. Classism certainly plays a role. Mm-hmm. Homophobia certainly plays a role within that as well. So looking at all of those aspects, it's been an interesting conversation. Like, for example, class situation, I'm a South Asian guy. But if I go missing, I know that I'd have the same level of search party that Andrew did, simply because I'm connected to the community so deeply and in a position of power within my organization, right? And even though I might be considered working poor, I'm still connected. And so that's my privilege that I have. So all those things combined, and we really have to revisit all of that.
I mean, I'm glad that you brought up the fact that there may have been folks kind of targeted who were most vulnerable. What I thought was really surprising was the Middle Eastern man who was sort of saved at the 11th hour, who wasn't out to the family. And we haven't really heard or seen anything of that individual ever since. But I think that really kind of really exemplifies the fact that in the gay community or folks who are, you know, sexual, well, not heterosexual, there is a sense of secrecy that can be preyed upon, which evidently he did.
For sure. And I don't know if it's secrecy or people just navigating their lives the best that they know how, right? And I know there's been conversation in the media about living a double life or a secret life or things like that. And I just wanted to sort of speak about that in that not many of these men from the Middle East and Sri Lanka, they're coming from countries who still have homosexuality as a criminal offense within, and some of them punishable by death, and sometimes a life sentence. So, you know, you have that innate fear. You have a society and a community that also, you know, is fearful of their loved ones being gay or whatever because they might be criminalized, right? When I came out of the closet, my mom's fear was rooted in the fact that she grew up in Sri Lanka where, you know, being gay is a criminal offense. And so her fear for my safety was the issue. And so it seemed like homophobia when it was really a genuine. So there's that aspect. And there is a flat out homophobia that exists within all of all communities and all cultures. So they had to navigate how they navigated. But I think his, you know, when you're looking at what he did and how he did it, he was really hoping to not get caught, it seems, because no one's going to pay attention to these people. And I think that's where he went wrong with Andrew, where he didn't realize how much connections he had.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of questions that's been raised about the investigation. His arrest in 2016 seems to be leading to, there's been charges related to one of the investigators of that we'll be hearing about later in the episode. But one of the things that I wanted to touch on is the fact that these are, you know, eight men who are no longer with us. These are, you know, there's brothers, sisters, family, and close friends, for everybody in the building, from Andrew Kinsman. It's had a major impact. And we've been hearing some of the victims' testimonies. I know that you folks put out your own victim impact statement. You know, what I thought was really interesting was how the 519, which is the community sports center in Toronto, outlined the fact that they'd invested about $100,000 in self-defense classes, in providing additional supports. You know, there's so much more cost to the community beyond the loss of the life that in terms of collective coping with it as well. So what were some of the things that were outlined in the impact statement that you folks put out?
We spoke specifically to specifically to the fears that people had faced, right? And not necessarily the cost to it, but really talked about what we were hearing in our one-on-one spaces, in our, you know, group spaces that we set up. Like tonight, there's another space that we're setting up in response to everything that's happened. And we're hearing definitely that there's still a fear of safety for individuals, especially if you're marginalized. So for individuals from the trans communities and racialized trans communities or sex worker communities you know, harm reduction or folks with substance issues, mental health, there's still an element of safety factor there for folks, and they still don't have trust in the system to watch out for them. And so that, we talked about that. We talked about specifically to the South Asian Middle Eastern community, in that, you know, there are individuals who are leaving countries where they're persecuted. They're coming to a safer country, and yet they're still being persecuted in a different way. So there's depression and there's anxiety. People are isolating themselves in their home and fearful of going online and dating people or meeting people and things like that. So it really does have a huge psychosocial impact on individuals outside of the cost factor. Right? And many of these individuals who are coming into this country or who are new to the country, they don't have the financial resources to go seek mental health supports that they need, right? And then when you're thinking about refugees coming into this country, how are we painting their safety in this community and looking at the resources that are available to them? Because in all honesty, if I look at the refugee folks that are victims here, if they were given a work permit, a temporary work permit, you know, they would have been able to have a proper job and not go seeking money or these landscaping jobs where they're paid cash and then now they're murdered.
Yeah, they would have had employers who would have noticed they go missing.
Yeah.
You know, just at the very basic level. You know, what I think is really interesting is that we've spoken to missing persons investigators from other jurisdictions who were astonished that Toronto actually introduced its first unit looking at sort of patterns only in, I think it was November, or maybe a bit earlier or later than that. But it was very recently for, you know, a lot of people introduced these units back when there was the serial rapist in Scarborough, blanking on the name. But, you know, these things have been around for a long time, but Toronto seems to have missed the boat. I know that the Honourable Judge Gloria Epstein, if I remember correctly, has the Independent Civilian Review Panel, which the Toronto Police Services Board launched. They've been calling to really take a look at the MacArthur case. I believe that you're on the panel. But the Toronto Police Services Board seem to have said you can look at missing persons, but not that specific case. Where do you sit in terms of that call for actually reviewing that case as well as the entirety?
Well, it's changed now. So in the initial terms of reference, when ASAP was a part of requesting an independent external review, in the terms of reference, we had to be very cautious on not speaking to the Bruce MacArthur situation simply because it was in front of the courts at that time and there was no plea. So now that there's a plea of guilt and sentencing is happening, Justice Epstein has put in a request to expand her scope to include this as well. So that would hopefully change if the TPS or the Toronto Police Services Board approves that request, then that would happen, certainly. And again, the missing persons, it was dumbfounding to me as well when, you know, it was only after this whole situation did the chief bravely launch a missing persons for one of the largest cities and the most diverse cities in the country that we don't have a missing persons unit. And again, I always keep saying that the police are doing a good job when seniors go missing and when children go missing, which I think is really important. But there's this whole notion, this bias that if you're in the middle age category, then, you know, you're allowed to go missing. But I'm like, even if someone wants to go missing, they'll tell somebody that they want to go missing, just leave me alone, right? Everybody. Yeah. So there's patterns of behavior. So it really is an opportunity for this review to get, again, shed light. And I, you know, it's terrible for me to say, but I will say it in that this whole atrocity has actually been a good thing for Toronto at the expense of these eight men. And then I'm grateful that, you know, the lives lost are not going to go in vain, that there's actually some real systemic change that has happened in terms of the missing persons unit. There's going to be systemic change that happens in terms of the review and the findings and make sure that these kinds of things don't happen again, or at least we're on top of it. We're never going to get rid of serial killers. We're never going to get rid of victims of crime. But what we can do is limit the number of casualties and the severity of those casualties, right? Or those crimes. So I think that's where we're headed to, and I'm grateful that you know, Justice Epstein has taken it on, and I'm really hopeful that we're actually going to come to a situation where we have strong recommendations so that the system improves, right? It's not to take down the system or to point fingers. The finger will be pointed, but it would also say, okay, here are some fixings that you can do to make sure that we move forward.
On the note of sort of improving the system and maybe improving the relationship between the community and the police more broadly, we've spoken on the show before about how the Pride Parade is one of the only spaces where queer folks have the power. This is our space. We invite who attend. We invite who we would not like to attend. It's one of the only vestibules of authority within queer folks. And so the role of whether or not police should attend there is so... well, to call it a hot topic issue would be an understatement of the decade, I think. But, you know, I think that's an interesting question. The Toronto Police, the Toronto Pride membership of, they voted against police participation for at least 2 years. Do you feel that the relationship with the Toronto Police Service will improve with the community in Toronto, specifically people of color, within 2 years to allow that conversation to happen again in the future?
There's a lot of work that needs to be done. I don't know if 2 years is going to be enough. Just because there's such a strong within the community, within some or within a majority of the members of the Toronto Pride folks, membership, but also in just in society in general. There's such a huge divide between the police and the community, but there's also other members of the community who have a great relationship with the police. And there's a lot of people in the middle who really don't know because, you know, someone like myself who's had a good relationship with the police, but also understand that my community is sometimes targeted, you know, that they're not being paid attention to when people go in missing. If they don't speak English and they go into a police station, there's really bad treatment there. So it actually demotivates people to go in and actively report and engage with police. So there's all these issues that need to be addressed that, you know, can slowly happen. But I also then think of the LGBT officers that have fought within the system to be recognized as LGBT officers, and how do they participate? And I think, you know, there was a real opportunity, and of course it's we can all have opinions sitting in the back seat of a car, but when you actually have to drive the car, then it's a different opinion. But my backseat opinion is that I think there was a real opportunity missed where we could take this opportunity to have a conversation around, well, LGBT officers exist, how do they want to participate? Yeah. Black Lives Matters are saying, you know, officers can participate, but not in uniform, not in guns, and no police cars.
Yeah.
So there isn't a flat-out ban of participation. It's how they participate, which I think might have been an interesting conversation between police and Toronto Pride, and then have the community, and then an opportunity to, you know, as a part of Pride, to have that conversation around the relationship that has been built, the areas where it needs improvement, and then also to acknowledge the fact that there are LGBT officers that have fought tooth and nail to be recognized within the force itself, and that's a harder battle to fight. But at the end of the day, Pride is a coming together of our activism and celebration of that activism and everything that we've achieved as a result of it. This is truly a role, and again, if we can have conversations with the internal support networks, with the LGBT officers, and say, listen, just march in your t-shirts, and with your Toronto Pride logo, have a banner that says Toronto Police Services Internal Support Network, have a great time, let's keep this moving forward, and then we'll continue to have these ongoing conversations so that we can maybe look at having uniform officers. And then the other thing that I would do is turn around and make a blanket statement that no uniform in the parade, right? No military uniform, no naval uniform. They come in and they march with their uniform. So we need to create some sort of equality there as well.
Absolutely. No, I think you bring it, you know, a brilliant point. I for a short while I was the liaison to the LGBT community for the Ottawa Police, and the conversation around wrapping a car in a rainbow is all about corporate branding for the corporation, which is, you know, the police service. And I think that we need to, like you said, we need to divorce that sort of corporate pinkwashing away from LGBT folks who work for the service and have those as separate conversations. I think that's a wonderful piece. Now, before we let you go, the Bruce MacArthur thing has had a massive impact. And we know that DASAP have been right at the forefront of that. What really has puzzled us from outside of the bubble that is Toronto is the decision by the federal government to give nearly $500,000 to a festival to find out what people across the whole of Canada would think of the relationship with the police. Now, we don't know what sort of relationship these people have in St. John, New Brunswick, or in Abbotsford, BC, to kind of have an idea. But I can see maybe the logic, given that the Bruce MacArthur killing spree was in Toronto, that focusing it there makes sense. I mean, that's not an illogical jump for me to make. But even then, we question, is Toronto Pride the most appropriate venue for establishing that relationship? So my question for you is, how efficient do you believe, or how effective you do believe that Toronto Pride would be as that sort of research body in connecting with the community in Toronto?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, given the relationship now with the community and Toronto Pride, and it's almost, you know, as strained as the relationship between Toronto Police Services and the community. But, you know, that being said, I think Fierté Canada Pride is putting on a conference today for all the prides across the country. Mm-hmm. They're capable of receiving funds from the federal government. They've been advocating for that. So if you're really looking at a national scope, then I think that seems seems to be the logical place, because then they can look at places like Nunavut and Abbotsford, BC, or wherever people are having their small town prides and their large city prides, to look at safety in a national scale and come up with a really solid report, if that's the workings of that or the intention of that grant. But I mean, if the federal government is also looking at, you know, Toronto specifically, then why not a smaller grant to sort of say, here's some money, let's figure out how we're going to do this together. And even then, given the unfortunate circumstances of Pride where it stands right now in terms of finances as well as staff capacity, etc., I don't know that, a few board members just resigned at the last AGM, so I don't know, you know, if that's actually going to be used. So there's a lot of questions, unfortunately. And again, being the backseat driver, I would have recommended Mr. Morneau to sort of hand those funds over to Canada, or Fierté Canada Pride, and say over the next few years, create a plan for us, and then let's look at national security and relationship building between Pride and LGBT Prides, or Toronto Police Services, or any of the police services. There are some Prides actually have an amazing relationship with their police services, and they've come to an agreement and sat down and had, you know, proper conversation to see how police participate or don't participate, and there's a mutual respect there. There's no hate. So what are they doing that we could do better with, and where are those areas still that lie?
I think that's great, and I think that Fierté Canada Pride does a great job of looking coast to coast and coast. And maybe it's important that Toronto be able to look from outside of the GTA to some solutions from Canadian brothers and sisters working as well. I know Vancouver has a phenomenal approach to how they manage the Pride parades. Well, I'll let you get back to your activities and the rest of the conference. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and the folks listening and kind of share your perspective.
Thank you very much for having me.
welcome back. You were just listening to Jennifer Loyola with their sophomore release of Glimpses of Indigo. That song was called Try for Love. It was actually related to trying to find love as an LGBT person.
That's the musician from Toronto, right?
That is a musician from Toronto who's been in the CBC Spotlight just recently. Now, during the conversation with Haran, and you know, like we say in the interview, you know, Haran and ASAP have been sort of really working at the forefront of South Asian and Middle Eastern men who were abducted by, murdered by Bruce MacArthur. Now, when I recorded that interview, the verdict had not been released yet. We can now tell you, our wonderful listeners, what the verdict was. And that is that Bruce MacArthur has been sentenced. He's been pled guilty to 8 counts of murder in the first degree, and he was issued with a life sentence. Now, you cannot have multiple life sentences in Canada for effectively the same crime. But if it's a crime that's happening at different times, so in this case there were 8 different victims killed at 8 different times, the parole eligibility can be different.
Okay.
So there was a bit of a decision change in 2010. So for some of the people who were killed, the criteria has changed between then, so the parole eligibility doesn't count for them. But the Crown was arguing that he shouldn't see parole until he's 116.
Right.
Which I think is something like 50 years, without parole. The judge had to weigh up sort of a whole bunch of things. You know, Bruce MacArthur pled guilty.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a major, huge...
it wasn't a drawn out trial, yeah.
Absolutely. And what I found really interesting about the judge's decision was that John McMahon, that is a tongue twister of a name, McMahon?
McMahon.
Well, it's M-A-H-O-N.
Yeah, but it's pronounced McMahon.
Oh my gosh, no wonder why I couldn't. Anyway, Justice McMahon noted that, this is what the CBC says, that there is a fine line between retribution and vengeance. And I think that's really interesting here, because even with 25 years before he's eligible for parole, that would still make him 91 before he can come out.
Yeah.
And even then, parole's not guaranteed.
Yeah.
You know?
That's until they do the hearing. And it could just be, you know, bureaucratic. We're going through the motions of a parole, even though everybody knows nothing's going to come out of it. But we go through the motions because that's the justice system. I mean, this whole sentencing right now just reminds me of that old saying that justice, much like sausages, can only be enjoyed if you don't know how it's made. So, I thought I turned that off. That's embarrassing. But this is definitely one of those situations where, I mean, it's not ideal, but the way he's arguing that, like, this, if we're going to have a just system, then parole in 25 years, but a parole hearing, not the actual parole, and then that would be fair. And I think that is, it's uncomfortable, but I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not in a position to disagree with him without being just some idiot on the radio. Well, but, I mean, I see where he's coming from, and I get it, if that makes sense.
What we do know is that what the judge says is that he doesn't think that Bruce MacArthur would have stopped. He believes that he would have continued to kill had he not been stopped by the police.
Right.
He didn't surrender. He didn't confess to his crimes. He didn't walk into a precinct and say, hey, it's me. He was caught through methodical policing, eventually, but he was caught by the police. McMahon also said that there has been no evidence of remorse during his interactions with the police.
Oh.
That, you know, he was caught, he was arrested, he was charged, and, you know, he pled guilty. Presumably the evidence was very sufficient. We already know that there was photographs of the victims on his devices.
And trophies.
Yeah. I mean, he may have had some very good advice to plead guilty and to hope for leniency from the judge.
Yeah.
But I think that when you plead guilty for something, it's supposed to symbolize a degree of remorse. And I think what the judge pointed out in this case was that act in isolation he wasn't a part of a broader pattern of remorse. He wasn't remorseful throughout the trial. He wasn't remorseful throughout his interactions with police.
So, I mean, normally I could see pleading guilty as an act of remorse, but sometimes it's just an act of acquiescing. Like, oh, you got me. You know, the evidence is there, and I don't know how to argue against that. It can also be that. It could just be you rolling over on the fact that they've got you, which in this case, it sounds more like that. Just, you know, he acknowledges that there's no way he can prove non-guilt. So.
Yeah, it was, there was a lot going on in the sentencing. He's banned from contacting the victim's families. He'll be on the sex offenders registry, which is hardly surprising.
Well, I should hope so.
And yeah, and although he apparently, according to the CBC, he appeared sullen throughout it, it's interesting. You know, a lot of community members are saying, yeah, and we're seeing this in sort of Facebook feedback and in Twitter. You know, people are outraged that he would even get parole at all, that they should throw the book at him and leave him rot.
Well, but the system needs to be fair. You know, that you need to grind up the animal to make the sausage, and this is not great. But again, like the idea of it, you know, 25 years, they go through the motions of parole, even if everybody agrees it's never going to happen. I think that, like, my ideal future would be in 25 years, they go through the motions of parole, assuming he's still alive, and then nothing comes of it. Because I would want to see the system working, because if somebody else who did a minor crime who was over-sentenced, mm-hmm. I would want them to get parole. Like, yeah. It's that awkward truth of, like, a just system is just for everyone, even people who you don't personally feel deserve it. So I would like to see him get parole, and then for him to fail at parole. That's what I would want. I would want him to get the parole because that's what I would want for someone else. And I would want him to fail the parole because screw that guy.
So what we know is the fact that he decapitated his victims, that he mutilated the bodies to bury them, that was an aggravating factor. The fact that the judge said his crimes have instilled fear and distrust in the community, mm-hmm. the community is never going to be the same again, that was an aggravating factor. The mm-hmm. fact he wasn't particularly remorseful was an aggravating factor. You know, the fact that he had a warped perception of his crimes, and it was all for his own sick, sadistic pleasure, was an aggravating factor. I mean, he's going to be 91 before right. he even sees the light of day for a parole hearing. And if we're still doing a radio show in 25 years' time, you can bet that we will let you know what we think of that at the time. Now, I'm going to jump to an interview from Heather with who is the president of Fierté Canada Pride, which is an association of pride festivals, mm. where we talk about what's sort of happening across Canada as some of the biggest barriers and major issues facing pride at the moment. And we'll be back just after that.
Hi, I'm here with Heather, the president of Fierté Canada Pride. I have noticed that whenever somebody says Fierté Canada Pride, they kind of keep talking in a Francophone accent immediately afterwards. We're here in Ottawa for your national summit, conference.
Conference and AGM. Yeah.
Absolutely. And there are so many people here. It was quite the challenge to find a quiet corner or nook to talk in, because I'm hearing whispers that this is probably the biggest conference of FCP that you've had?
This is. We've got over 40 prides represented from across the country, including the territories, at least two of our territories, I believe. And representing, we have 70 members, so to have 40 here participating is excellent. We've got 200 people wow. joining us, over 200 for this conference.
That's phenomenal. I mean, that's a huge number. We know that Canada is seeing Pride community, Pride's coming together in communities all over the place. You were telling me earlier there's now 120. You guys released that infographic a little while ago. What was the thinking behind creating that visual for the community?
We created that graphic as part of a present proposal that we put towards Heritage Canada. So that was sort of a graphic aid to inform people who may not know about Fierté Canada Pride and the Pride movement in Canada. Mm-hmm. And part of our proposal is to advocate for a Pride's fund for Prides in Canada.
Excellent.
Now, this government has been far more friendly than some previous governments. In particular, we've seen the special appointment of the special advisor, Randy Boissonneau. You folks had an event on the Hill yesterday where I think you had, 30 MPs reaching out, which is a massive number. How is your relationship? What's your relationship been like with the federal government and politicians this year?
I have to say Randy's office has been very supportive. And one of the things that we were advocating in our meetings yesterday with the various ministers, we were asking for that Pride's Fund. We were also advocating for a fund for the community centers, the queer community centers across the country. And the third thing we were advocating for was that the position of the special advisor be raised to have more resources so it can be more effective on our behalf, having the level of a minister and more resources behind it. So our relationship is growing. The federal government just announced $30 million for international LGBT organizations, and we're hopeful that with all of the work that our various meetings yesterday, we'll see similar movements in Canada.
Well, I think you certainly have the reach at this point with, you know, the 40 communities represented here and the 70 that you work with. One of the things that we find quite interesting at Kwankwe is the sort of the dynamics of a small community coming together and forming a pride. And typically, it's a quick march around the block and a little picnic in the park, and everybody knows everybody. There's usually a drag queen who's sweating all of their makeup off because it's the middle of the day. You know, these are, then that differs very much from the much larger urban center prides. So given your membership, what do you think the makeup is in terms of smaller prides and larger urban prides?
Well, most of our new members are all of these young, new prides that are developing. They've gone from just a picnic to actually having more presence in their community. The main prides are, remain Toronto and Vancouver and Halifax and Montreal. And I probably missed one, and I'll apologize. Edmonton, Calgary, Saskatoon. And then we've got a number of medium-sized prides that are in that in-between zone, and they're kind of stuck in terms of funding, trying to reach that next level. And then we have a huge number of the smaller prides looking for resources and support to get started in their community.
I think we're seeing the really large prides hitting a bit of a critical mass. We're seeing it in New York. There's talk of an alternative parade popping up over Stonewall. And we won't get quite into the Toronto and what's happening there. I think I'll save you that conversation. But we're also seeing, I think, even Victoria's having talk of an alt-pride. You know, once a pride gets to a certain size, do you think that this splitting of the community is something that naturally happens or something that can be avoided?
I don't know if it's something to be avoided or celebrated. Like, the role of Pride is to provide a platform. And if you're not able to provide the platform for some of the voices in your community, then I think we should celebrate those who have created their own and find a way to perhaps work together and recognize that there's, some prides have reached the point where they're at their capacity. They can't grow anymore. Mm-hmm. So creating opportunities for perhaps more diverse voices or more marginalized voices is a way to make room for all of us. And right now, Pride has been dominated in the past by men, for the most part, white men. And it's taken us a while to get more diversity within our local organizations so that we can better reach out to the diverse populations within our community.
Now, not all prides get it right all the time. I think our community is very apt at calling out mistakes. But at the same time, I think even in really small communities, I'm actually thinking of the community between Moncton and Fredericton that sort of inadvertently raised the straight pride flag last summer. You know, what kind of guidance does FCP offer to these young prides, and even in some cases much older prides, who are looking for guidance out of some hot water they may have landed themselves in?
Well, a lot of times when there's an issue that comes up with a pride, we know of a similar story in another situation. So we're able to put them in direct contact with somebody who's worked through that. So they know, hey, these are the you know, this is what the mistakes we made. These are the things we've learned. And also within our network, we can often provide the contacts that they need to better reach out to solve their problems. And I think we also provide a stage for those smaller prides through our social media so that the stories that happen there aren't isolated and they don't just fade away and one more person's hurt and not it's not heard. So
I think actually your social media approach is phenomenal. We as folks here at CanQueer, we look at the CBC or 20 odd different gay news sources and your social media feeds specifically to see what's happening in these communities. One of the things I wanted to ask is, you had a session, I believe, earlier today on the big issues facing Pride. What if you can share, what emerged as sort of some of the consensus topics as being the big issues facing Prides across Canada?
Well, the panel that was talking about, it wasn't just what was facing Prides. That panel was on the queer community. And so we had different representatives. We had a Two-Spirit person from Two-Spirit in Motion. We had somebody from the community center. So it was sort of, what are the issues facing the queer community across Canada? And so Pride was just one of the voices at the table. So the main issue that we're running into with our is the lack of funding, right? We are at the peak of the funding of what we can do without more funding.
Yeah.
And if we want to make changes and have more diverse voices and not be dependent on corporate sponsors and the dollars that come with that, we need to have other sources of funding. And we offer a huge economic impact to our communities. Over 6.5 million people attended our events in the last year alone. And most of that work and all of those festivals, a lot of it was done on volunteer labor compared to the jazz festivals and some of the other cultural festivals that are adequately funded by because they're recognized as an important part of our culture. So we're trying to remove some of the barriers that we have towards accessing some of those funds.
Absolutely. I think that's such a great point. And I think what's really important is that local LGBT folks kind of also contribute. You know, I think donors and monthly giving, even bequeathments and estate giving, these are all ways that people can support their communities and support their local prides. Do you have any other things that you'd like to share with our listeners across Canada before we call it a day?
One of the pieces that came up in the conversation today, one of the questions was, you know, this sort of the pull between Pride as party and Pride as protest. Mm-hmm. And the way I answered that question was, I see us moving forward with choosing Pride with purpose.
Mm.
And it's a way to encapsulate that protest, but still celebrate who and what we are. So I think that, you know, moving forward, if we can encourage more of our members to have a bit more purpose in how the choices and decisions that they make on a local level, I think it'll benefit the community altogether.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. And I know you have a million and one things to get to throughout the rest of this conference. And we'll be speaking hopefully with Andrea a little later as well. Thank you so much.
Hear these words that I sing to you. I will make it clear, it's me and you. We can have this love that we never lose. It's bigger than us. Take my hand and I'll lead you home. Can you understand? You will never be alone. It's bigger than us. It's bigger than you and me. It's bigger than us. It's bigger than everything we see. 'Cause I can feel the universe when I'm feeling you breathe. It's bigger than us. And it's bigger than you. Give up and I won't let go, 'cause it's kind of bigger than everything we see. Yeah. Oh.
Welcome back to Can Queer. That was Michael Rice singing Bigger Than Us, which has the slow build-up, 30 seconds in, massive drop. It is a Eurovision song.
When Luke first played it to me, I predicted what was going to happen every step of the way, like 5 seconds before it happened. Like, okay, we're going to get a drop soon. Ba-doom. Like, okay, it's going to pick up now. Da-da. Okay, they're going to do like soaring vocals now. Okay, there you go. It's got that Eurovision formula.
Yep. Well, that was Michael Rice. He won in Britain's competition to see who will represent them at Eurovision. They have not won in 24 years, I think.
I don't get it. Like, Britain's made, like, Radiohead and the Beatles and Imogen Heap and all these really talented musicians. And then the people who go to Eurovision are just, what are they doing? I don't get it.
I think it was Sarah Alto came 24th. In last year's Eurovision.
Why don't they sell
No, Suri, sorry. It was Suri that was...
Everyone loves Adele.
I know. I mean, that'd be cheating if you just send Adele. Anyways, we're going to jump now to an interview that I did with Andrea Arnott, who is the executive director of Vancouver Pride. And we'll be back just after that. I'm here with Andrea, who is the executive director of Vancouver Pride. So our listeners at CGSF in Burnaby and Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO FM, will be happy to hear that I'm speaking with Andrea, your local executive director for your Pride. Now, you're actually way the other end of the country here in Ottawa for the Fierté Canada Pride conference. How are you finding the conference so far?
It's been great, as always, to connect with people from across the country. It's very cold outside, and I'm not used to that. I'm a wimpy Vancouverite. Coming together at a conference like this, making those connections, talking to people about issues that they're facing is really helpful for us as an organization to not have to reinvent the wheel all the time.
Actually, I was talking to Heather earlier, who is the president of FCP, and they were saying that one of the biggest issues seems to have been effectively core funding and just funding. Money seems to be the biggest challenge. Is that something that you're seeing as a big challenge in Vancouver?
Yeah, of course. All of us as Pride organizations would always like more money because we'd like to be able to do more. But one thing we've really been focusing on is diversifying our funding. So making sure that we have our corporate sponsors, that we have different levels of government funding, that we apply for any grants that we're eligible for, and looking at donations and anything else that we can do to sort of diversify our funding to make sure that we're stable.
Awesome. Now, what a lot of conversations are happening about, prides that are in big cities, such as Vancouver, which is quite a big city, what they reach a sort of critical mass, and then people are going off and creating their own thing, either in protest or from not seeing themselves reflected, or, is there an effort to foster these splinters, or is there an attempt to kind of do everything?
I think for us at Vancouver Pride Society, we recognize that we can't do everything and be everything for everyone. However, myself coming into my position in 2016 as a woman, coming into a leadership role at a Pride organization hasn't happened a lot in past years, and Prides have been critiqued for being very focused on cis white gay males. And so one of my determinations when I started this job was to kind of steer the big Pride ship in a slightly different direction. So after I got our 2016 season finished, we engaged in a year-long community consultation. And so we've tried to incorporate the suggestions and data that we got back from that process to better meet the needs of the community. So I think prides do need to be responsive to what their community needs and change and keep up with what the community needs are. However, we do have alternative events in Pride. There's I think they call it Alt Pride, that the Vancouver Arts and Leisure Centre does, and those are more kink fetish, sex on premise parties that happen, and they have a whole series of events, and we support that happening because we can't provide that. Mm-hmm. And then Black Lives Matter has organized a separate march, and we fully support people going to that if that's what they need to do to celebrate Pride and come together in solidarity. So we also have a bursary fund where we encourage small community groups, maybe they're marginalized, don't feel comfortable coming to Pride, to apply for a bursary to support events that they're already doing in their own community to meet their needs. So we fully support people doing what they want and need to celebrate Pride.
Thing you mentioned Black Lives Matter, because I know that in 2016, maybe just before you started, there was you know, the Toronto parade was blocked in the protest, and I think actually Vancouver's approach to it really acted as a phenomenal role model to other pride festivals. As a Ken queer, we talked about it, we talk about it a lot because we were impressed with the mechanism. Are you able to tell our listeners a little bit about what that mechanism is and maybe kind of what the impact it's had a couple of years down the line?
Yeah, for sure. My entire career has been focused on doing diversity and inclusion work just in a multicultural setting. And I'm a big believer in bringing people to the table and listening to all sides of an issue and trying to find that common ground. And so in 2016, when I started, those conversations were happening in Vancouver with BLM. And we, of course, had lots of reactions from the community about their requests. And we just listened, and our board and I were very steadfast in saying, like, we're not reaching a decision. We're not reaching a decision. We are listening to all pieces of this giant puzzle around this issue and took our time to make a decision. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't ruin the relationship that we do have with Vancouver Police Department, but also to hold them accountable. So we were really happy with the decision that we made. We've stuck to it. It will be the same for this year. No uniforms in our parade. We didn't cave into demands to make an immediate decision. We had media asking us every week, have you made a decision? Have you made a decision? And we just were like, we're not ready yet.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a monumental decision. It has a huge impact. We've seen the impact it's had on Toronto, for example. But I mean, I think you folks also introduced a trans inclusion pledge where anybody participating had to clearly show that they're walking the walk of inclusion. And it sort of levels the playing field in terms of, you know, here's what we value as a society, as an organization. Do you match these values? Has that been a successful initiative?
Yeah, for sure. The Trans Equality Now pledge started before I came into my position, but continued for 2016 until the legislation changed to protect gender identity and expression. So with holding people to a standard, like you can't be in our parade unless you sign our pledge, it ruffled feathers. But I think it stood up as an example to say, like, no, you know, Pride isn't just about a big giant party. We actually are a Pride movement, and we need to advocate for people who are still marginalized. And that sort of led into, for us, we have a parade matrix now. So anyone who applies to be in our parade, their application goes through our parade working group, which is made up of community members, and it changes every year. And we score people on a values alignment, if they have all their policies and procedures in place, and if they've had any incidents of homophobia, transphobia, or discrimination. So we do reject people based on their application if we know that they've had incidents or there isn't a good values alignment. So we're pretty stringent about who gets into our parade.
So, well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. Hopefully the folks listening from Vancouver and, of course, the rest of the country have a bit of a better sense of what a pride the size of Vancouver is really looking at. From the sounds of it, is listening, it's engaging, it's diversifying, it's reacting and responding to community needs. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having a chat.
Hello and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media.
That was a good episode. Lots of interviews.
Lots that we didn't get to. Yeah. We're hoping to cover some of the international news that happened, such as massive funding from the Canadian government internationally. But we won't get to that until next week. And
super convenient when a conference is in town and you get to interview all these interesting people. Yeah.
I've been Luke Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. And thanks for listening. Hey, you. It's me again. Hey you. Stone in my shoe. I've been aching for your love. You're so heavy. I have got to let you go. I'm going with this hero. Gravity, zero gravity, zero gravity. Hey you.